Nalu FM Finance Podcast. Insight into the financial markets.
Often people just get trapped in seeing something that's volatile move in a volatile way and react too quickly to it. Yeah. It has to be in an extraordinary way for you to react to it.
This podcast is powered by Vesta, the engine behind active management. Vesta is a Switzerland-based fintech startup that provides software for issuers of actively managed certificates to automate their value chain fully. Visit Vesta, V-E-S-T-R.com, to schedule a meeting with an expert and to learn more about Vesta.
I'm here with Gary Dugan, CEO of the Global CIO Office. Thank you very much, Gary, for taking the time. Maybe let's jump in right away. What is actually the Global CIO Office, so our listeners know who I'm talking to here?
Yeah, there's a clue in the headline. It's actually a group of CIOs who have come together to form a group that want to act as the investment department of EAMs and multifamily offices, and also provide services into single family offices. Our client base at the moment is actually a good combination of family offices and small wealth management businesses. So I think a number of people are realizing that you need some real expertise. It doesn't come cheap, and therefore you don't always need a CIO for the full year. You might need them for a few hours a week. So we are an outsourced CIO services model.
Now, I obviously don't have as much insight as you, but I also sit on some of these investment committees. And I often find that many of these investment portfolios are overexposed to what the original founder or partner has the personal interest in, like, or it is property. But how should actually these people, when you come in, how do you tell them, how should they look at their investment portfolio?
No, that's a very good question, because often people just get anchored on a very old asset allocation and don't introduce new assets. And it's also true that if you're actually working for the principal, it's very difficult sometimes to put up new ideas because you could end up losing your job. So we can be used as that advisor who comes from external and can actually put up some good ideas. So it is as simple as saying, you know, your asset allocation today just references two or three assets. And particularly, as you suggest, it's things like private equity or their industrial holdings. And it is real estate. But what it isn't is private debt markets, venture capital, even just the pure simple equity markets in different parts of the world. Again, everyone says, I want to invest in the S&P 500. Except, have you heard of China? you know, it's an ongoing problem. I think, to be honest, the biggest issue for many of those single family offices is the asset allocation, and it is anchoring on the past.
Mm. Now, maybe probably a philosophical question for you is, what do you consider the difference between investing, speculating, and betting?
Yeah, I'd like to think that everyone does investing, but in my career, investing is destroyed by speculation, speculative investments, and betting. If you think about long-term investment, it should come with a fair degree of due diligence. And I think everyone starts there saying, look, I've looked into all the details. I know the upside and downside. I can see the 5 to 10 year view, and I'm investing for the longer term. Unfortunately, that's fine when you're talking to a machine, but when you talk to a human being, that's when emotion comes in. And I've always liked the concept of behavioral finance, because quite frankly, that's what creates economic cycles. And the one way of controlling for that is to say, look, we will look after X percent of your portfolio. And for your own whims, ideas, bets, we're going to give you 10% of your wealth or 5% of your wealth and go play with that. But once you start to mix those two things together, you're in trouble.
Yeah, fair enough. Which leads me to my next question. Is your definition of risk? Is it the unexpected loss of capital? Is it standard deviation? I mean, in a sense.
Yeah. So the way in which I'd like to think about it is that there's no normal distribution to risk. So the first thing I say to people is, you know, what's the upside risk? What's the downside risk? I.e., what's the skew? You don't use the word skew, they wouldn't understand it, but just getting them the concept of that there is never just an easy upside and downside of equal value. The second way in which we try to control risk is to say, how confident are you? So anyone can say the S&P is going to be up 10%, but But if you say, well, what are the other outcomes and how confident are you about your call? Then I think you start to control for risk. And yeah, risk comes in many, many different ways. And it's a bit like the way in which people look at portfolios today. They go, I just don't need these fixed income securities. Yeah, they're going to lose me money. Everyone tells me that the 10-year yield in the US is going to 3%. So why should I hold fixed income? And you say, well, remember COVID? Remember the crashes we've had in the past for circumstances you'd never thought of? That's why you must have a diversified portfolio. And that's why you must still be holding assets that you think will lose you money. Risk is not one-dimensional. It's definitely not a standard deviation. It is multidimensional.
So when you actually go about in allocation capital for your clients, how do you do your asset allocation? How do you measure it? By risk, by notional, by, is it on a, you know, factor, or how do you look at that?
I think, for, you know, with the work that we're doing in the wealth industry, it's trying to never put the outcome of the portfolio in a position where you're going to get an emotional outcome from the clients, right? So, and I think then that plays very much to how much risk are you taking with drawdown here? And not just, and we keep telling people, not just one movement, but two or three movements down in terms of potential risk. So to the degree that you can, with the tools at hand, very diversified portfolios, trying to cover off the risks that you see at hand, which would lead you to a catastrophic outcome for the portfolio. If you can mitigate that risk, then I think the balance of your portfolio is right. And of course, unfortunately, what tends to come back in the other direction is, how can you make me as much money as possible? And the two are quite frankly incompatible. Because yes, if you're going to take that kind of bet on making huge amounts of money for your client, I always say, and it can come back to bite you in equal magnitude to the downside.
When do you actually decide to invest? When do you pull the trigger, and how do you spread it, in a sense?
Yeah, I've gone through so many different models. I started my career at the National Coal Board Pension Fund, where the approach for everything, every purchase and every sale, was to do it on either rising relative prices on the selling side or falling relative prices on the buying side. And as an institution, we're extremely patient in what we've done. Unfortunately, over the decades, patience has gone out the window.
Exactly.
These days, we are almost forced to commit the money straight away. But if I can, I try to get the client to say, look, give me a 3-month window here, and we will average in almost automatically, hopefully into falling prices if you're committing to the market. But the aim would be to average pricing over a short window.
And once you have that portfolio in place, when do you review or rebalance then how quickly you need to react?
I would say what we try to do is, I call it rebalancing, is just to have a really good deep dive formal look at it, I would say once a quarter. But what we normally do is we just have, you know, a kind of tech background that's telling us when maybe certain securities are moving by inordinate amounts. And I think often people just get trapped in seeing something that's volatile move in a volatile way and react too quickly to it. Yeah. It has to be in an extraordinary way for you to react to it. So if you keep that balance right, then you shouldn't have to reshape your portfolios too often. I don't think you'd really want to change your portfolio more than, let's just say, in a structural way, more than about once or twice a year.
And how do you look at when you, the underlying investments regarding liquidity?
Yeah, I don't know. I think one of the free lunches that's been out there for some time, although it's getting whittled away, is the illiquidity premium. I mean, quite frankly, I'm quite disappointed with a client when it doesn't quite get my concept that, listen, you know, you don't need daily liquidity when you're really committed to this mandate for the next 5 to 15 years. And I know private debt has got a bit of a dirty name, given some of the scandals that have gone on in recent times. But yeah, there are private debt funds out there that give you that monthly liquidity, and people are going to balk at it. And yeah, I can offer you an opportunity in an investment that gives you a 7% yield, has done every year for the last 15 years, but you have to tie your money up for 28 days. So I think that's an opportunity. For others, they see it as an inordinate amount of risk. But, you know, I do say to people, please, please, you've got to take the illiquidity premium. If you, I suggest monthly or quarterly. We can also look at private equity that locks your money away for the next 5 years. I don't like it when it locks away for 7 to 10, as some of these vehicles still do. But, you know, if you're just in liquid markets, I think you're taking an inordinate amount of risk because you're trying to squeeze a return out of a out of a dry bone these days.
No, I couldn't agree more. Now, something of it that's very close to my heart, because that's where I came from, the investment bank side, is what are derivatives, in a sense. And how do you see derivatives? You know, are you more the people like to quote Warren Buffett, who says weapons of mass destruction, or do you think they have some use? And if they do, how do you like to use them, or you like to see them used?
I think they have a value, but I do think they have a value principally in an institutional setting. For people using options, futures, and derivative strategies in what I call a naked way, right? So I want to go out and hedge my portfolio, therefore I'm going to use a certain derivative strategy. But what I have time for is derivatives wrapped into structured products to a degree. And I'll give you one example, which is no longer valid because there are no interest rates around the world anymore. Mm-hmm. But I remember back in the late 1990s, we were able to buy a structured product on a one-year time frame that gave us 130% of the upside in the Japanese equity market.
Yeah.
And if I went and bought an ETF, I get probably 99% of the index performance. And if I gave it to an active manager, I get plus or minus 5 percentage points either side of the performance. So we decided to use the structured product. Now, obviously, hidden inside there was a derivative strategy of some form. So I think if they're wrapped up in a manner in which it's kind of relatively easy to understand the payoff, and it gives you a better opportunity than a Delta One product, then absolutely. And I think for most clients, what can they do if they think the market's going down? They can sell. Well, actually, there are other ways of doing this so that you can make money as the asset that you hold is falling in value. So, as I said, structured products wrapped in a certain way around even a private client portfolio is still a added value.
Now, probably more recent is artificial intelligence, machine learning, robo-advisor. I think that's what you refer to when you said let the machine do some of it. But what is your view on this? How much can this add versus the human, and how should it be applied in this process?
Yeah, I think it can add a lot. I've been an absolute believer in quant work for quite a while. You know, I think there are certain aspects of our decision making that require you to absorb a lot of information. But let's just say we have a one-dimensional model that says if the business confidence indicator in the United States goes up 5 points, then typically 80% of the time the S&P 500 is then up in the next quarter. Why wouldn't you use that relationship in terms of trying to button down some of the information that you look at? So rather than looking at the ISM survey and saying, I think, you say, actually, on a probability weighted basis, I know what's going to happen. So the data we've used with the past has been a very simplistic approach, but the adoption of AI, the adoption of real-time data in particular, rather than a confidence indicator that was taken 6 weeks ago and is reported 2 weeks later, you know, we can get real-time data now that can give us an insight into the market and an edge. And I don't think that's just for the hedge funds. I think it's for every investor. If aggregated up by good quant work, you can use that information, and it's very added value.
Another probably buzzword, two more I would like to see where you see trends, is sort of ESG. How does this... I find historically it came mainly from excluding, if you wouldn't meet certain things. Now more and more it seems to be also an opportunity. Where do you think this is going?
I'm not sure either of those. I just know it's absolutely going to be probably one of the most important influences on markets going forward. I think I think the fund management industry is only just waking up to it. But the recent changes at the European level with these the 6, 8 and 9, which is going to be the bane of every platform's life. So, you know, what kind of fund it is, whether it's ESG or not, and the degree to which it is ESG. Everything is going to be graded by this criteria going forward. And I do think that the pension funds and the endowment funds of the world are just going to very simplistically say, every investment that you make for me, Mr. Manager or product provider, has got to be compliant in some way with some shaping of the standards being set. So I think it's going to be a very, very important factor. I think there's absolutely a need for a lot more true ESG product. But the biggest problem we have, we can't even define ESG. In fact, even the EU doesn't define the
ESG. That would have been my next question.
Regulations doesn't define it. It is appalling what's going on. So I suppose we don't want big government to tell us what ESG is, but we do have to start to collect around a shared vision of what ESG is and measure our products on an index weighting or whatever basis in order to get a proper conversation in.
Last sort of trend, because you are located, you right now, Gary, are in Singapore, Asia. I find Asia very exciting. There's a lot happening. I think a lot of the countries, particularly outside China, will benefit from certain friction that the US has with China. Vietnam is one of the markets I know a little bit more. But you sit there, you locally, what can you say about it?
Oh, it is huge. And I really do think that I would say west of the Middle East, there is still a complete lack of understanding of the scale of what's going on. I mean, I think people absorbed in the last 12 months that China's big and that China will be the largest economy in the not too distant future, and clearly accelerated that trend last year with its GDP growth at a time when the rest of the world was struggling. I think the difficulty for Asia is to deepen its financial markets. So we'd all like to buy Chinese GDP, but quite frankly, you tell me how many funds out there can easily say that they've got a proper setup to manage the bond portfolio at the moment, or indeed even in the equity side, that they have sufficient people on the ground to really know where the opportunities are around that vast country with so much going on. And I think the other point is that we talked just about ESG. China is the biggest ESG player on the planet. It's going to be spending the equivalent of about $10 to $15 trillion on cleaning its country up in the coming decades. No other country, even Mr. Biden, President Biden is not making that kind of commitment.
Being the CEO of a company, there's a lot of demand on your time. And how do you structure your process and maybe your surroundings? I don't know what tools you use to be efficient in this way.
The best advice I give is you've got to be totally focused. You have got to run your own agenda. And when you sit down at your desk, what is the most important thing that you need to do today? Make sure you do it. And often people get distracted by the markets moving in the morning or someone made this comment. If you do that, you will get distracted, you will get diluted down, and you will not be as effective as a member of the team as you might have hoped.
Great. Thank you. Last question, a question I always like to ask everybody who I get to interview. What are up to your three favorite finance movies and why?
Well, I'm only really going to mention one, which is The Big Short. And the background to that is that I was working at Merrill Lynch through what you would say is that phase of the markets from 2007 to 2009. And I honestly, I think in the prior year, 2006, I really couldn't understand what was going on. I really couldn't understand it. And then we got into 2007, I'd been bearish and kind of wrong. And finally in August, I saw the whole thing tip over. And I still didn't understand why it took us another, quite frankly, 12 months for us to kind of work through it. So I was on a flight watching The Big Short. I hadn't seen it. And in fact, I didn't see it probably for the first 6 months after it. And I was screaming at the back of the seat in front of me, because it was just starting to be revealed to me what had been going on. And I was totally appalled. I mean, I was totally appalled at the time anyway. But to see the behaviors of the gods of our industry at that time and the very, very weak individuals that have created these kind of situations, and quite frankly, the huge fraud that had gone on, I think that was the most shocking film I ever saw. And as I said, I'm sorry for my fellow passengers, but I was actually quite emotional at watching that film.
Excellent. Thank you, Gary.
Thanks a lot.
Nalu FM Finance Podcast. Insight into the financial markets.
This podcast is powered by Vesta, the engine behind active management. Vesta is a Switzerland-based fintech startup that provides software for issuers of actively managed certificates to automate their value chain fully. Visit Vesta, VESTR.com, to schedule a meeting with an expert and to learn more about Vesta.